Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
When it comes to school funding, what's a fair split between state and local governments? 75-25, 60-40, how about half and half?
Deal's a deal and a 50-50 split. Just for the man on the street, sounds like a reasonable thing to do.
Also tonight, two Florida lawmakers have been unable to pass a needle exchange program in recent years, but with a rash of new HIV cases, their efforts seem to be making headway.
We had 1,411 new cases alone in Miami-Dade County. Broward, my home county, 993.
We'll also get into the differences in the way juvenile offenders are often treated in the country versus the city and find out why the umpires discussed in a legislative committee this week aren't the kind who call balls and strikes in baseball. I'm Tom Flanagan. At the close of week 5 of the 2016 Florida lawmaking session, this is Capital Report. The Florida Senate has rolled out a plan its education budget chair says is aimed at creating parity between state and local funding for school districts. Len Hatter reports the move sets up a potential showdown on tax cuts.
Republican Senator Don Gates says his plan would make the state a more equitable partner when it comes to funding schools.
If we do nothing, the state of Florida this year would be a minority partner in the partnership. But if we take the action that is proposed in the bill, which if we approve it today would go to the full Appropriations Committee, we would establish with respect to this fiscal year a 50-50 definition of partnership.
Gates is a former district superintendent. He says the idea, which the Senate has floated for weeks, is not an attack against Governor Rick Scott or the House, which have based their education increases on property taxes.
It is not a criticism of anyone else who may view this issue differently. It is simply a way of trying to frame and encapsulate the discussions that we've had on this subcommittee and discussions that that other senators have had.
The Senate wants to increase education funding by $650 million. But under Gates's plan, the state would pay for half of the increase and the districts the rest, instead of districts paying the majority. Lawmakers have expressed concerns the state is not picking up a fair share of the cost of running schools. But Republican Senator David Simmons of Maitland wants to make sure the local portion of the taxes are paid by actual homeowners and not because new properties through development have been added onto the tax roll.
That portion should not be used as some basis for not having a fair required local effort being assessed. And that's what I'm concerned about.
Both Senate President Andy Gardner and Budget Chairman Tom Lee have expressed support for dropping the local share of what's called the required local effort in exchange for the state paying more for schools. Also on board is Democratic Senator Bill Montford of Tallahassee. He also heads the Florida Association of District School Superintendents.
And a deal's a deal and a 50-50 split just for the man on the street sounds like a reasonable thing to do.
The move to decrease property taxes for schools could be seen as a tax cut, which sets up a clash with the House, which is pushing its own ideas for cutting taxes. The Florida House and Senate have passed differing proposals for what's shaping up to be an $80 billion spending plan for the upcoming fiscal year. They'll begin meeting soon to iron out differences and come up with a final proposal to send to Governor Rick Scott. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Len Hatter.
After years of trying, lawmakers are finding success with a plan to create a needle exchange pilot program in Miami-Dade County, and we get that story from Nick Evans.
There's still almost a month left of session, but the dead bills are beginning to pile up. This week saw the door close yet again on a nearly decades-long effort for LGBT civil rights. But Another long-awaited undertaking has reason for hope.
For the past 2 years, myself and Representative Katie Edwards have filed. Before that, I filed it 2 years before that in the Senate, and we've been working to make this pilot happen.
That's Miami Democratic Senator Oscar Brannon, and the pilot he's talking about is a Miami-Dade County needle exchange program.
What the program does is it allows someone to bring a used needle or syringe, and in return, they get a clean needle back.
Brannon's partner in the House, Sunrise Democrat Katie Edwards, says with intravenous drug use growing, lawmakers need to ensure it doesn't compound into an even more dire public health crisis.
In Miami-Dade County alone, one of the top five counties in Florida having the highest number of reported new HIV cases, for 2014, we had 1,411 new cases alone in Miami-Dade County. Broward, my home county, 993. Orange, 503 new cases. Hillsborough.
So far, Brannon's done pretty well, moving the measure through the Senate. Last year and the year before, he was able to shepherd it through committees and onto the floor. But the matter hasn't budged in the House. Part of the reason is that as long as needle exchange has been around as a policy solution, there have been opponents, criticizing it as an at least tacit approval of drug use. But this year, two things are different.
Members that I've spoken to had this sentiment that this is not my issue, not my area. What changes when I'm able to say it's happening in Manatee, it's happening in Hillsborough, it's happening in Northwest Florida, in the Panhandle, in the most rural areas, because, as we all know, we're seeing an increase in drug use, even in rural areas.
The other is a greater emphasis on connecting participants with drug counseling and addiction services. Stewart Republican Representative Gail Harrell says that's what got her vote.
One of the things I want to point out to members who perhaps have some concern in that we are facilitating the use of heroin and drug addiction, there is a strong component in it that requires that drug abuse prevention and treatment counseling and referral services are part of this pilot project.
She and every other Republican save one voted in favor of the measure at its second committee last Wednesday. It's got one last stop in the House, and once again it's waiting for a vote from the full Senate. The progress is almost too much for this guy.
I'm so excited and amazed that...
This is Hansel Tooks, an internal medicine resident at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. But back in 2009, he was a public health student conducting surveys of used syringes on Miami streets. Later, as a med student, he studied what dirty needles were costing his hospital.
So what we did was we did a study where we looked back through the records at Jackson over the past year to see how many patients were hospitalized with bacterial infections that came from drug use. And what we wanted to know is how much those easily preventable infections with needle exchange cost our public hospital system over a year. And that figure was $11.4 million.
So now, after 7 years of patiently lobbying for the program, he's understandably excited at what it could mean for his community.
And it's just a wonderful opportunity to do what's best for a very vulnerable population of people and let them know that somebody cares about their life. Because in my experience, when we show these people that somebody cares about their life, we're more likely to be able to get them clean and hopefully disease-free.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Florida's free clinics have been active at the Capitol this week, asking lawmakers to remember them in the state budget for next year. Dozens of clinic volunteers helped make the case for a $4.5 million budget item to help fund the 125 free clinics statewide. They insisted their services keep uninsured Floridians from getting badly sick. State funding for the free clinics began with a $4.5 million appropriation in 2014, which the clinics say allowed them to provide about $160 million worth of services. Last year, lawmakers approved $9.5 million for the clinics, which was then vetoed by Governor Rick Scott. Still to come on Capitol Report, the juvenile justice system in a big city like Miami may treat young offenders differently than the system in a small town such as Brooksville. Is it an unfair discrepancy or just the way things are?
You're never going to have equal justice because judges aren't going to make the same decision. Providers aren't going to make the same decision. Law enforcement officers aren't going to make the same decision.
Even some of those wrongly convicted of crimes may not be able to get compensation from the state. but a bipartisan bill aims to change that.
This is a modest change. It just says that the only felonies that would fall under the clean hands provision would be those certain violent felonies that are the worst of the worst.
Lawmakers are considering a move to regulate the insurance appraisal industry.
Today, a felon could be an appraiser. Today, a felon could be an umpire.
And we'll hear the latest on a bill compensating the family of a former Florida State University football player.
Nothing could ever bring DeVaughn back. No amount of money, $1.8 million, isn't worth DeVaughn's life. But it's just the closure that we're looking for. We have to relive this every year, and we just want to be at peace.
Support for Capital Report is provided by The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Since police were given the option to write a ticket instead of arresting juveniles for petty crimes, civil citations have been heralded as a huge success in Florida. But now, as Jim Ash tells us, some lawmakers want to make civil citations mandatory, and critics are up in arms.
When a cop catches a juvenile drinking a beer, smoking a joint, or swiping a T-shirt, he doesn't have to make an arrest. He can write a ticket. The juvenile gets community service, and the Department of Juvenile Justice saves thousands of dollars processing another child. Everybody wins, right? But Republican Representative Carlos Trujillo of Doral says it's no longer a matter of smart justice, it's equal justice. He says kids who commit a minor offense are getting arrested in one part of the state and ticketed in another.
The consequences of the crime or the punishment that's administered should not be different by CERC, and it should not be different by county. Then a child or an adult arrested in Duval County should be treated the same exact way under the law as a child arrested in Monroe County.
Trujillo's solution is to force police to issue civil citations for a handful of misdemeanors, including drug possession and retail theft. Police would also have to issue a civil citation for battery, but only if the victim agrees. Barney Bishop, president of the business-backed Smart Justice Alliance, supports civil citations. But he says this goes too far. He warned the Justice Appropriations Committee that police will start filing more serious charges just to get a suspect off the street.
Mandating that they give a civil citation when the officer thinks that maybe instead that they should be arrested is morally and ethically wrong, because you're taking away their training and their ability to make that decision.
He said supporters are fooling themselves if they think police in Miami and Pensacola will ever treat simple drug possession the same way.
You're never going to have equal justice because judges aren't going to make the same decision. Providers aren't going to make the same decision. Law enforcement officers aren't going to make the same decision.
Republican Representative Eric Eisnagel of Orlando said leniency does some kids more harm than good.
Members, I would simply ask you to reflect on that. Kids need boundaries. And we are looking at a bill that erases one of the few boundaries that's left.
But some people don't think the bill goes far enough. Democratic Representative Daryl Roussan of St. Petersburg thinks obstruction of justice should also be on the list.
An officer sometimes arrests a kid because he mouths off. And while we don't condone such a behavior, it shouldn't result in an arrest for the first time.
James Miles, a church elder who works with youth in St. Petersburg, wants Trujillo to drop the language that lets battery victims decide whether their perpetrator should be arrested. He's worried a schoolyard brawl and a grudge could result in a criminal record that scars a young person for life.
You have taken hope away when they find out it's really no use. I can't be, I can't do what I want to do. I can't be what I want to be. I made this mistake. Where do I go from here?
The bill passed the committee 12-1, with Eisnagel the only no vote. It has one more committee stop before reaching the floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
A bipartisan effort to revamp Florida's wrongful incarceration compensation program is moving through the legislature. Kate Payne reports the proposal could make it easier for exonerees to get that compensation.
Florida is one of 30 states that automatically compensates those who are wrongfully incarcerated. But Florida's eligibility requirements mean not all exonerees get paid out once they're free. That's because of the Clean Hands provision passed by the legislature in 2008. Under that provision, people with prior felony convictions cannot be automatically compensated, even if those convictions happened while wrongfully imprisoned. Senator Rob Bradley of Orange Park says the law is too strict.
And basically, if anybody had committed a felony at any point in time in their life, including some drug possession when they were 18 years old, and then they were later found wrongfully incarcerated for another crime at a later date, then they are precluded from obtaining compensation. I think that's wrong.
Senator Arfina Joyner of Tampa sponsored the original wrongful incarceration bill back in 2008. Now she and Senator Bradley are working together to ease the eligibility requirements. Bradley says the proposal would amend the Clean Hands provision, but it wouldn't eliminate it.
This is a modest change. It just says that the only felonies that would fall under the Clean Hands provision would be those certain violent felonies that are the worst of the worst.
Joyner raises the case of William Dillon, who is denied automatic compensation because of the possession of a single Quaalude pill.
William Dillon, who after 26 years in prison for a murder he did not commit, could not seek compensation under the wrongful incarceration law because he had a past conviction for drug possession. So this bill is an effort to address this inequitable situation.
Back in 2008, supporters hailed the Wrongful Incarceration Act as a historic move towards justice. When the bill went to the floor, only one lawmaker voted no, Senator Jeremy Ring of Margate.
When we originally did wrongful incarceration, it was 159-1 vote in the Florida legislature. I was the only one to vote against it, and I voted against it because of the Clean Hands Amendment. And Senator Joyner at the time was very upset at me, but I think she over time understood and accepted that no vote, and probably the best vote I've taken since I've been here. But I want to thank you for doing this now, and now I can support your wrongful incarceration bill. Thank you.
Some critics would rather see the Clean Hands provision eliminated altogether, but Bradley says the proposal is a step in the right direction.
I'm proud to join Leader Joyner in support of this bill that is grounded in a deep respect for the Constitution and the understanding that the one thing that the government can do to somebody above all else that is the greatest denier of their rights is to incarcerate them.
The bill has one more committee stop before it heads to the Senate floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Lawmakers are looking into new rules for umpires.
Strike three!
No, not that kind. Property insurance appraisal umpires, as we hear from Regan McCarthy.
If you're wondering what in the world a property insurance appraisal umpire could be, don't worry. You're not the only one who's confused.
Do you have any specific questions for Representative Artilles?
I probably will when I understand the bill.
That's Senate Regulated Industries Chair Rob Bradley talking with Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvala about a measure filed by Miami Republican Representative Frank Artilles. Artilles says the bill is simple.
My bill simply says, for you to participate in this arena, you have to be licensed.
Artilles says without requiring licenses, consumers are left unprotected.
This bill regulates who could participate in the appraisal process. Today, a felon could be an appraiser. Today, a felon could be an umpire. So when you have hundreds of thousands of dollars in insurance proceeds that are entire industry is unlicensed. What I'm simply doing is this is a license.
Now, let's get back to those terms. An appraiser in this case is someone who assigns value to a loss. So if a person's property has been damaged and it was covered by insurance, the property owner and insurer might both use appraisers to value the cost of the damage. If those numbers are different, they'd use an umpire to help mediate. But Artillis says umpires need more oversight.
Right now, if you have a claim in your house and you have an appraisal, you basically don't have any information on the umpire. You don't sign off on the umpire. And 9 times out of 10, the umpire will split the baby, as explained by the gentleman from DFS. So if I, as a consumer, have a $100,000 claim, the insurance says it's 20, usually the umpire says, you know what, I'm going to split the baby because I have to get paid by both sides.
Under Artillis's bill, both the consumer and insurance company would have a say when it comes to picking the umpire. And the measure puts rules in place about who can be an umpire, including requiring a certain number of hours of continuing education. But that has some people, like Reggie Garcia with the Florida Justice Association, concerned, since often retired judges are umpires.
Retired judges who have presided in civil and contract cases dealing with millions of dollars in disputes are now going to have to go downstairs to the DFS office and pay for a new license and take 24 continuing education credits in addition to the 30 they need as Florida bar members.
So, Stewart Republican Senator Joe Negron proposed a plan to exempt judges.
A retired judge who presumably would have, in most cases, decades of experience in deciding between two sides presenting evidence. I think a retired judge, is capable of making those judgment calls without having to get additional training.
Negron's amendment passed, but that only addressed one of Garcia's concerns. He says his organization is also concerned, for example, about the rules in the bill relating to fees.
I, as the homeowner, would have to pay 100% of my appraiser, 50% of the umpire. With President Margolis's amendment, that's now capped at 500, and 50% of all the experts that the umpire hires.
Garcia says in some cases, those costs could start to outpace a claim's potential payout. After a lengthy discussion, the measure passed out of the Senate Regulated Industries Committee on a 7-3 vote. It heads next to the Banking and Insurance Committee. A similar measure in the House is awaiting a hearing on the chamber's floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Trying to clear up uncertainty for a federal appeals court, the Florida Supreme Court said this week that a man should not face gun charges related to being a convicted felon. The unanimous ruling this week stemmed from questions raised by the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in a case involving Bobby Jenkins. He was a defendant in a criminal case in federal court in South Florida. The Supreme Court opinion said Jenkins and another man were indicted on robbery and drug conspiracy charges after being confronted by detectives on the way to a home invasion robbery. Jenkins was also indicted on a charge of possessing a firearm as a convicted felon, but the federal appeals court asked for an opinion from the state Supreme Court because of questions about whether Jenkins was considered a convicted felon under state law. The question stemmed from Jenkins pleading guilty in 2008 to a felony charge, but having what's known as a withholding of adjudication. In such situations, defendants can enter pleas and face punishment, but avoid having convictions on their long-term records. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, about a week after friends and family of a former college football player advocated on behalf of their loved one's claims bill, it passed its first committee hearing in the Senate. Sasha Cordner reports.
DeVar Darling says he remembers how he and his brother Devon always wanted to go to Florida State University to play football.
We committed to this place before our senior season in high school. This is where we wanted to be. And on February 26, 2001, was the worst day of my life, losing my identical twin brother. And Devon is buried in a Florida State uniform down in Houston, Texas right now because we love this place so much.
15 years ago, Devon Darling collapsed and died during a grueling preseason football drill. Since his death, FSU has since changed the way it conducts those drills. The Darling family reached an agreement with FSU to receive $2 million. Under state law, the university can only pay $200,000 and give the rest through what's called a claims bill. But in the years the claims bill has been filed, it's either never had a hearing in the House or Senate or has died in the committee process. And DeVard and his family have had to talk to lawmakers year after year.
Nothing can ever bring Devon back. No amount of money. $1.8 million isn't worth Devon's life. But it's just the closure that we're looking for. We have to relive this every year. And we just want to be at peace. And we just beg and ask for the legislators to find it in their heart, you know, to have a heart. And remember that it's not just a claims bill, but it's a life behind that claims bill.
Joined by family and friends, which included former teammates, DeVard spoke at a press conference to help get the bill heard earlier this month. Jacksonville Democratic Representative Mia Jones was also there. She is carrying the House version of the claims bill, which has never really had a hearing. Still, she says she too has been lobbying to get the bill heard in her chamber. And Jones adds she knows it hasn't been easy for the friends and family of Devon Darling as well.
And in each one of those meetings, they recognize and share their story and the story that this family has had to endure over the past 15 years since his death and 12 years since the first claims bill was filed with the Senate and with the Florida House.
Senate Democratic Leader Athenia Joyner, the bill's Senate sponsor, had similar comments.
You know, this bill has been lingering 12 years in this legislature. Senator Al Lawson carried it for 5 years, and I've carried it for 7 years, and it is time. I want to believe that Senator Diaz de la Portilla, too, will do the right thing, the just thing, and hear this bill.
Miami Republican Miguel Diaz de la Portilla is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the bill's first committee stop. And a week after Joyner made her earlier remarks, her bill was heard in his committee.
Senator Joyner, you're recognized to explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an unopposed claim bill for $1.8 million. It's based on a final judgment supported by a settlement agreement between the Darlings and the Board of Trustees of Florida State University as compensation for the death of Devon Darling, which occurred during preseason football drills in 2001.
And the Senate measure passed the committee and has two more stops before heading to the floor. A similar claims bill for Devon Darling also passed last year during its first stop in the Senate Judiciary Committee, but it died in the committee process. Meanwhile, the House version has still not had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox. And I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report. And join us again each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol. Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.